This is the Saxo Market Call, the daily financial markets podcast, across asset classes and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Thursday, 20th of April, 2023. Markets really aimless here if we look at the S&P 500, as I show on slide 2, or look over at the NASDAQ 100. Very, very tight ranges. We were back and forth a little bit more yesterday than the prior day, but still ending around unchanged. This 4170 area on the futures. I suppose the most interesting thing going on in the backdrop here is with this low volatility, we're seeing the VIX dropping sub 17 and to its lowest since late 2021. And we've also expressed concern about the narrowness of this rally. It's even more marked, the rally off the lows at the beginning of the year in the NASDAQ 100, because this year's returns, as we discussed yesterday, have largely been driven by the mega caps. And good Jim Bianco, I've put a tweet up there. Do follow him. He's a great follow. Lots of good stuff coming out from him. Just putting some figures on the narrowness of all of this, saying that basically the 8% or the 8 stocks, the FANG plus MNT stocks, have contributed the vast bulk of today's gains. And if you look at the broader market, 492, as I put at the bottom of the third of that string of tweets in the thread, 492 of 500 stocks in the S&P 500 cannot beat cash year to date. So while we are somewhat at the elevated end of the range, everyone's waiting for what shoe it is that's supposed to drop. We've priced in a little bit more rate tightening. We've priced in eventual rate cuts, but there's not a lot of drama in terms of incoming data moving that picture after we've sort of stabilized, maybe mid-range-ish, since the Silicon Valley Bank collapse. I think with just lower VIX levels, it's certainly gotten a lot cheaper to buy some insurance here, and that would be my instinct, is to be concerned as we look forward. And a couple of reasons for that. So on slide 3, as you can see, very low VIX there, sub 17 as indicated, the lowest sort of weekly close since the modern era, basically post-pandemic breakout, has been around 15. Just above 15, in fact. And so we're actually working down into those types of levels. So some forward levels or forward issues to be concerned about: budget ceiling / debt limit concerns coming in. The timeline for that supposedly was meant to be late July, but it could be as early as early June because tax revenues are underperforming what was expected. Now, if we do make it beyond early June, there is a round of tax payments coming in. I believe it's mid-June. That would then punt the issue to late July. But crunch time is coming. You see yesterday the news emerging that the House Republicans have forwarded their bill for cutting for the fiscal year forward, and it's on the order of looking for $4.5 trillion in reduced spending. So that's not for 1 year, but spread over time, of course. But this is totally unrealistic, I'm sure, from the Biden's administration's point of view. And they're also calling for a halt of these cancellation of student debt. So there's that issue. Feels like there's so much dysfunction within the Republican Party and factionalism there that you wonder if the two sides are willing to take this game of chicken to the very edge. Hopefully there's a bipartisan commission, an effort afoot that, if it gets sufficient support, could punt the issue to beyond the election, where we would have to revisit it in early 2025. Let's hope that moves forward. But it's just an issue to be concerned about as we head into this time frame pretty soon here. As well, we're drawing down the Treasury General Account. This is that drawdown is introducing liquidity into the market to the tune of around $500 billion since late January. And it's getting as low as it really can get, as you can see on that chart there on slide 3, down sub 100 billion. This indicator does not go to zero. All right, and then in across markets, Ola, we talked a little bit about, you know, where should we focus here. There's not much of a pulse, and there is a little bit of a pulse on a couple of individual currencies, but saw a pretty big dip in crude oil yesterday. Did we entirely close that gap, or are we getting close?
Well, we are getting close, but we're not there yet. As we highlighted earlier in the week, we are seeing weak refinery margins emerging, especially in diesel, but also now in gasoline, and just highlight that that demand outlook is potentially not as strong as previously expected, and that just basically raises the risk of this gap in the price. I haven't put a chart in today, but it's very clear to see on any chart, either Brent or WTI, that the gap is down to 80 in Brent and it's down to 75-70, I believe, in WTI. So that is acting at a magnitude. We also just to remember that most of the buying that occurred following the OPEC production cut happened within a week in a very narrow range, around 84.5 in Brent and around 80 in WTI. And obviously a lot of these positions are now all on the water, and that's adding to the downward pressure. So this is not a significant change in fundamental. Is simply just positioning that's once again getting squeezed now to the downside, whereas they were squeezed to the upside a couple of weeks ago.
All right. And then in FX, as indicated, the broader situation, not very interesting. The dollar doing very little here, pretty much sideways. The yen quite weak, as we did see a new little peak in the yields on that UK hot inflation CPI print. That's also come back in. It seems like everything just wants to mean revert after extending a bit. I guess the most extensive move overnight certainly was the Kiwi. So we got that Q1 CPI in considerably below expectations. And you can see that Aussie Kiwi chart there on slide 4, the scale of the Kiwi weakness there. Also Kiwi versus the dollar posting a new low below the former range. And that particular move not holding quite as well, as the dollar has come back in a tad weaker this morning as well. And then the oil-related currencies have also seen quite a move, actually. Dollar Canada looks like it's rejecting that move below the 200-day moving average. And Nokia just once again weak with this dip in crude oil prices not helping out. I guess one thing that stopped and reversed quite effectively yesterday, semi in the currency space, oil was gold, which sold off very heavily. I think I saw it down to 1970 or something like that at one point yesterday. And it bounced quite strongly. So a pretty solid show of support there, to say the least, given that yields didn't really do much.
Yeah, exactly. Let's start off with, we're just moving forward a bit. Take a look at slide 8, where I just got the gold chart in. And as you can see, as you mentioned, John, we dipped down to 1970 and managed to recover almost all the way back to 2000. That's a fairly strong signal, I would say. But it's also clear that apart from some long liquidation following a very strong run-up, which has added some downward pressure to gold, the markets that gold coal traders are currently watching like a hawk, basically the dollar as usual, but also the short-term interest rate developments. I highlighted the current correlation between the dollar index, which is at a negative 0.7, and the SOFR December futures contract, which yesterday was also above 0.7. It's dropped a little bit, but it really is that's really where we should focus. So basically, a further drop in the SOFR future, i.e., indicating a reduced rate cut by the end of the year, will potentially at this point in time have a negative impact on gold. But the key level still remains below in the 1955-60 area, and so far it's holding quite well. But one market that has actually enjoyed quite a bit of a bounce here from that recovery, or the correction in gold, has actually been platinum. Platinum has seen a $100 contraction of the discount to gold during the past, I believe, 8 trading days. So it's gone from around a discount of $1,000 to down to $900 yesterday. Part of that is positioning. You can see on the right-hand side, since the banking crisis really kicked off in early March, we saw a massive spike in gold lent, up 113,000 contracts, whereas the platinum position merely managed to scrape back into a net long of 9,000 contracts. So that basically means now with the correction we're having in gold, the selling pressure in gold is much greater than it is in platinum. But at the same time, platinum has actually managed to make new highs. So we're getting close to that 1,100 level. It does indicate that the underlying fundamentals are currently improving. We got outages in South Africa. We also have Russia, which is the other key producer. These are when production is concentrated among two major sources, it obviously makes the supply side a bit risky. At the same time, we have the green hydrogen economy attracting more demand for platinum. On top of that, ETF demand has been weak for quite a while, but it's starting to pick up. And if that continues to pick up, that could potentially move the platinum market into a deficit this year, and that will add some further strength to the upside. So most certainly one to keep an eye on. But for now, the initial move is driven by the positioning. The gold long was much bigger than the need to reduce gold longs were much bigger than what we saw in platinum.
All right. And now for something completely different. We're going to dip into an area we don't bring up much, but I think this time of year in the Northern Hemisphere is a good time to do it. And it's also a good time to do it because we're seeing a shift in the major weather pattern that can really wreak havoc, or at least mark significant changes in the global climate. And that is this very odd and very long La Nina episode of, 3 years, is now shifting to a El Nino pattern, and what that can bring with it. And then on top of that, I would just add, there's an interesting thing going on here in terms of cleaner air and what that actually could mean in terms of forcing worsening climate change. And that cleaner air move was the cleanup of the oil that, or the fuel that the global shipping was burning. So traditionally, if I'm not mistaken, they would burn something called bunker fuel, which is incredibly nasty stuff that basically can't be used for other applications and contained huge amounts of sulfur dioxide.
No, I think it's not. It's getting close to almost what you use to put in asphalt. It was at the bottom of the barrel, as I say, coming out of the refinery process. So just really the crap that you couldn't use for anything else.
Or that was difficult to refine, I suppose, or whatever. But in any case, they're now forced to clean this up, and cleaning with something called scrubbers that clean out the sulfur, meaning that there's less sulfur dioxide going into the atmosphere. And there's an irony in that dirty air actually helps to mitigate some of the CO2 effects of having increased CO2 in the greenhouse effect by blocking out simply all that dirt particles and nasty stuff in the air, actually blocking out some of the solar radiation that reaches the Earth's surface. And so there's a chart I put there from a Reuters article on slide 5 showing on the sort of the left axis the shipping emissions and how much those have dropped, you know, from this range of 10 to 12, whatever the unit is. I don't really care, to megatons per whatever year, down to 2, so a drop of 80%. And then you can see that the solar radiation getting absorbed by, I don't know if that's in the water, in the air, but regardless, on the Earth, has risen tremendously as a result of this. Clearly a correlation there. So I just wonder if we should be concerned about that general, weather events in general from this. But besides that, the shift in the El Nino pattern, and you've put up some useful charts and graphics here on slide 6 on that front.
Yeah, it's just phenomenal what kind of impact sea surface temperatures has on the global climate around the equatorial Pacific, it's called equatorial Pacific, just west of South America. And what we've seen, as you mentioned, John, in recent years, was that the surface temperature were colder than normal. That's the green line that we had last year. So that's basically at the bottom of the 5-year range, and that basically has concluded now at the beginning of the year. So we're moving in the other direction. So the black line you can see is basically the temperature is now rising again, and we are starting to face what we call an El Nino weather risk, and that basically is once again potentially creating havoc not only in South America but also in North America and at least also in Asia. Just recently we've seen some of the sugar prices rise to a 10-plus year high due to a limit of reduced exports out of India due to production issues. And it's just basically highlight the weather is, climate change or not, one thing we know for sure is the weather is just becoming more volatile. And it's creating more concerns about the crop outlook. And basically we should expect that volatility is going to continue to stay with us for the foreseeable future and create these period of strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, and that I suppose that chart on the right there doesn't specifically say so on the map. That's the pattern for an El Nino,
exactly.
which brings the risk of that main grain growing belt in the U.S. suffering from the type of conditions that don't support output. So we don't want to fear monger on this. It's just something to be aware of, and especially interesting, I think, on an additional wild card that is unpredictable and could be forcing things. With, like you say, with or without climate change, is something like this bizarre volcanic event that we've never seen before, an underwater volcano erupting in Tonga in late 21 and into early 2022 that increased the amount of water vapor, which is actually a far more powerful greenhouse gas than CO2, by 10% in the upper atmosphere. Predictions that this could mean hotter weather around the globe for up to 10 years, but just want to bring this in as an interesting talking point today. Let's round out, Ola, the commodity space with gas. I'm really fascinated, as always, with this space. I mean, you've got prices in the U.S. that I have to imagine are not at least encouraging significant investment plans to increase output and maybe actively damaging future supplies. I don't know, but it's just remarkable where we are in terms of both the price, and obviously that's related to where the supplies are, which look quite plentiful for now, at least for Europe.
Yeah, exactly. And despite the continued increase in LNG export out of the U.S., prices of gas remain weak in the U.S., but also in Europe. And we just today we're seeing gas prices, the benchmark front month gas TTF, trade back below 40 euros a megawatt. We were touching 50 in early April when there was a few outages in Norway, which supported prices. But right now the price is coming down. LNG shipments booked LNG shipments over the coming months could indicate that we may see a record of arrivals of LNG. So basically competition from Asia is not really picking up to the degree that we should worry. And it has raised speculation that we may actually see inventories, gas inventories in Europe fill up by the end of August. That's the green dot I put in there. If that is going to materialize, then we could easily see prices drop even further down towards 30, and then we are really starting to get close to some of the long term averages, further improving the outlook for Europe. But some of that is structural weak demand, whether that is due to the economic slowdown or just simply that the industry has become smarter in the way they use their gas, that's still a bit of a question mark.
And some of the energy intensive applications and production methods and facilities, to my understanding, as we've discussed before, BASF moving those, for example, out of Germany and into other geographies. So there could be some permanent demand destruction, I suppose, mixed in there.
Yeah.
All right, let's move forward to earnings, where we got Tesla in the most speculated upon stock out there. Many of you following that stock will have no doubt covered or had a look at what they said after the close yesterday. But in case you haven't, this, I think it's the sort of the impetus around these price cuts that has investors concerned and the reason for the 6% drop after hours. So they are increasing deliveries quarter on quarter, but their actual revenues decreased because of those price cuts. There was a big 5%+ price cut on the Model 3 and Model Y just ahead of the earnings announcement. And they said in the guidance that they're looking at further price cuts. And this, you know, really impacts the margins more quickly than the drop in the lithium carbonate prices affect battery production cost, etc. So not happy news for Tesla shareholders there, but you know, there's a lot to look forward to in the pipeline to see if this if they can pick up revenues with the Tesla Cybertruck, etc. I think one other story, and actually I put in the on slide 10 the forward projections. These are annual projections for where Tesla revenue ends up in the coming this year and the coming 3 years after that, and you can see the slowdown in the growth rate. So that's an important consideration. But if that 2026 revenues are realized, it would be on the order of 50% the size of Volkswagen. And then finally, in this space, I put up a little story there. I think this is really worth checking out. China's CATL, so the biggest EV battery maker, unveiling and are announcing a condensed matter or condensed state, I think they called it themselves, battery that they are saying will be nearing production or will be in production by later this year and is sufficiently power dense to even power civil aircraft. They're very sort of dodgy, or not dodgy, but they dodge sort of questions on who they're working with on this condensed state battery. But I was looking at that power density and comparing it to this 24M technology that we've discussed on this podcast before. It's the technology that Freyr, so F-R-E-Y-R, is looking at ramping up. I think it's a Norwegian U.S. company. It has a similar power density. So I'm wondering if they're not working directly with 24M, if it's a similar sort of semi-solid technology. But this is just game-changing stuff for power density, and the implications are tremendous into the space and can only really accelerate the interest in EVs as replacing ICEs. If we can figure out the electrification and electricity angle to deliver the recharging capacity needed. So just a flagging that story. And we have a wide variety of reports out today. CATL itself, I did not see the earnings announcement out yet, even though it's quite late in China as of this podcast recording. Volvo, Union Pacific, of course, the big rail freight operator in the U.S. American Express, maybe some insights into consumer behavior. Blackstone, D.R. Horton, a home builder, et cetera, et cetera. Next week, the really big stuff starts to ramp up, and we'll have Peter on coming back Monday. He's traveling both today and tomorrow. Won't be on the podcast. All right, let's look forward to the macro calendar today. We get some more housing data. I think, to my mind, the most the key thing to pick up would be at 12:30, the U.S. Philly Fed is out today, and normally not a huge focus by any means, but only because of Monday's shock turnaround and very positive reading on the Empire Manufacturing survey. Is this a sign that there's a turnaround in manufacturing and possibly that turnaround driven by this industrial policy moves, CHIPS and Science Act, Inflation Reduction Act, etc.? Of course, if we get an inline data point for Philly Fed tomorrow or today, it's expected at minus 20 or something like that versus an even worse number in March. There's no story there. But I would say if it's a zero-ish number or better, maybe we have something going on here that we need to delve into to understand what's driving this almost whiplash-like turnaround in manufacturing. There are other surveys that we need to get a look at, and we'd have to see the official ISM for the full month. But there would also be heightened focus on Friday's U.S. preliminary S&P Global PMI manufacturing number as well on that. So just a story to keep track of. The latest claims data also out today, a whole raft of Fed speakers as we're getting close to radio silence before the May 3rd FOMC meeting. And then that Japanese national CPI, does that ratchet up the pressure on the Bank of Japan to move forward with a more normalization of its rate policy? So stay tuned for all of that. And we'll, of course, see where things stand tomorrow with the next Saxo Market Call.
Thanks for listening. This has been the Saxo Market Call. For feedback and questions, reach out to us on Twitter @SaxoMarketCall or by email, marketcall@saxobank.com.